This episode is brought to you by Skillshare. Many people have contemplated that the purpose of mankind is to continue the spread of life throughout the cosmos. But how exactly would the Earth, our garden of life, spread its seed? So today, we will be closing out our fourth year here at Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur, and I am your host, Isaac Arthur. One of the themes we've looked at since the beginning of the show has been how even just a single planet hosting intelligent life can rapidly, at least on astronomical timelines, seed an entire galaxy with life, and I thought that would be an excellent topic to discuss as we head into the new year. Now, this episode is part of the Generation Ships series, but like the last one, Sleeper Ships, is more about alternative approaches. We'll actually be covering two of them, Seed Ships and Data Ships, as well as some hybrid versions, and also some unexpected uses they might have. We usually assume that faster-than-light travel, FTL, is not possible in these episodes, or at least not something we'll discover for a very long time. So that ships often take more than a lifetime to arrive at their destination, and that permits us five different approaches. The first three are the Methuselah ship, one on which the crew has access to life extension, the Sleeper ship, where we freeze everyone till they arrive, and the Classic Generation ship, necessarily huge vessels, able to move lots of living, breathing people, and their descendants, and an entire ecosystem. Our other two types, which are our focus for today, are the Seed Ship and the Data Ship. We have an additional type, the Gardener Ship, which we'll discuss next time in the series, but which is not distinct in method, but rather in purpose. It colonizes worlds in sequence, and we'll see some parallel examples today, where you are not necessarily colonizing new worlds at all. But what is a Seed Ship? What is a Data Ship? Last episode, in The Santa Claus Machine, we took a look at various types of replication technology, essentially any machine able to replicate itself and presumably do an additional task, a mining machine that could make other mining machines, for example. However, that might not require much intelligence or complexity because it's quite simple. Ones sent to other solar systems presumably need better automation. A seed ship is a relatively small ship carrying samples of frozen embryos or DNA and the necessary equipment to terraform a planet, or more likely just the templates for such equipment, as any machinery able to terraform a planet would dwarf even the largest generation ships we've discussed thus far. Note that this is still true even if the terraforming agent were something biological, like some genetically engineered terraforming microbes. The total biomass necessary to affect an entire planet would be huge, but you only need a small initial sample for the journey as they will replicate. Needless to say, we'd like to be able to use self-replicating machines for this too, but the key thing to a seed ship is not its size, but rather its purpose. It arrives and terraforms a planet so that when colonists arrive, they can just move in, not spend centuries terraforming it themselves. It's an ideal combination with a sleeper ship, since those colonists can just be frozen on Earth and unfrozen on a new world already covered in life, not endure century-long voyages followed by centuries of terraforming. This could be a tiny ship carrying a lot of self-replicating machines, or some massive factory ship that arrives with all its gear ready to go. We get an example of giant terraforming seed ships run by an artificial intelligence in the Stargate SG-1 episode Scorched Earth, which is a good reminder that any such vessels need to have a fairly sophisticated intelligence on board, not just for the complex process of terraforming, but making sure you don't do it to an already inhabited world. It could be unmanned and run by an AI, or it could have a team of engineers who operate it. Those engineers might be training their descendants to do the job, or be very long-lived, or be frozen for the trip. They might pack up when done and move to the next world to be terraformed, akin to the gardener ship approach. But the usual assumption is that it's automated and small, using sophisticated AI and self-replicating technology. Which raises a point. We don't actually need frozen samples of anything. DNA can be printed. Every organism follows a relatively simple schematic that can be encoded and printed, typically one consisting of a lot less data than would be needed to make a video briefly explaining what it was. In early discussions of generation ships, we didn't even know what DNA was, and data storage was about the same weight and bulk as a normal paper book. As we learned more and got denser data storage, it was inevitable someone would ask why we'd even need frozen samples, especially considering DNA can't be easily data compressed. You don't need 10,000 full copies of human DNA to send 10,000 samples, just the variations between each, which are comparatively few, and indeed overlap massively with most other mammals and even with plants. A freezer containing DNA or even frozen embryos need not be very large to carry a sample of every single member of a species, but you barely need any extra room for genetic diversity of a species when it's only the data and only the relevant differences. Now, there is a lot more to brewing up life than printing a bit of DNA. Your DNA does not have all the information needed to make you. Your mitochondria and microbiome, for instance, have their own separate DNA. But more importantly, you are not just your DNA, but your memories. A newborn human left to themselves, even given food and shelter, is not going to turn out very well, and humans are hardly unique in this, albeit we are one of the least instinctive species. As we saw in Exporting Earth, many species need social continuity and learned behavior. This raises a problem for a typical seed ship, be it using frozen samples or digital ones. It needs to be able to raise those first organisms. I also said that the idea of a seed ship is to prepare the way for human colonists who arrive later, but they need not be arriving on a ship. Obviously, if you can grow and raise animals who need nurturing and learning, it implies you might be able to grow and raise people too. But you need to be as smart as a person to raise a person, or at least close to it. And this brings us into data ships. Many folks feel the future of humanity, or at least of people, is not biological or even necessarily physical. That some or all people in the future will be digital consciousnesses, uploaded or artificial minds. Also, a point we often raise on this channel is that any unmanned probe smart enough to do any of these things is not actually unmanned. It has to have an intelligence on board parallel to or exceeding a human, and possessed of a fair amount of adaptability of thought if it's going to be operating far from home. So your seed ship might make use of uploaded minds to raise the organisms it grows while terraforming. So let me correct the standard definition of a data ship. A data ship is not necessarily an unmanned ship containing all the data needed to make machines and organisms to colonize a planet. To the contrary, it is almost inevitably a manned ship. Either it's carrying one or more AI, sophisticated enough that it probably deserves to be called a person, or it is carrying actual human minds in digital form. And either form might be a Methuselah ship or a sleeper ship, just depending on if those digital minds are awake or asleep for the trip. It could also serve as a gate ship, a type we sometimes see in science fiction that has wormholes or similar that makes the long voyage to a place and opens a portal home, through which colonists can instantly step through. Without faster than light travel, but with data ships, we can achieve something similar, where copies of minds are beamed at light speed to their destination. Time passes, but from your perspective, you left Earth and awoke in a cloned or android body an instant later. Time can be frozen on the data ship too, in the sleeper ship role of stored minds, but can be subject to damage or degradation. Of course, a beam signal could be degraded or pirated. Someone could sneak a receiver in the way that captured transmitted minds. That's a concern for stored minds on von Neumann probes too. If they keep replicating and sending out new copies ever further, they are almost bound to eventually bump into something that's likely to be intelligent and curious. The universe is a big place, and neither it or such an expansion swarm stop at the galactic rim. Such stored minds could make excellent ambassadors to alien civilizations, but could also make excellent victims if they are not too ethical. They can, after all, go the friendly route and chat while running a second copy of such a mind that they are applying the digital thumbscrews to simultaneously and in secret. They don't need too much justification for paranoia either. A terraforming machine endlessly going to world after world, including yours, can make you pretty dubious and worried about its creator's true motives. Note also that if it is planning to terraform a planet, which is not necessarily a given since a digital civilization might want to make worlds rich in hard drives and processors, not flora and fauna, it would also be carrying digitized minds of any animals that were not totally instinctive in behavior. Why raise a bunch of elephants yourself when you can stick a digitized elephant into a robotic elephant to do the job instead? And again, this is all assuming the intent is to terraform a planet. A data ship might be planning to colonize a system as a giant Matryoshka brain, a Dyson swarm devoted to computing and simulating. Even a seed ship might not be planning on terraforming, but instead be aiming to get the basic infrastructure in place for when the colonists arrive. Basic mineral extraction and power production, Estelazor to slow the incoming colonial fleet down, various space habitats for them to use as homes when they arrive, and so on. Needless to say, since data can be stored very small and potentially at the atomic level, data ships are often seen as better because they're so small. Ditto seed ships if they still contain that basic machinery for self-replication at their destination, generally what we call a von Neumann probe. The ship is tiny and arrives and replicates itself, both to colonize that destination system and to send copies off to other systems. It's a small ship, and you technically only need to build just one, though you'd probably build several and launch them in different directions. This requires two big caveats right away, though. First, you wouldn't actually build several back home. You'd build one and target it at the first random asteroid in your own system, and given the implied size is often microscopic, or certainly no bigger than modern spaceships, you could crank out enough from a single asteroid to hit every star system in the galaxy. There are two problems with that. First, you could also just tell it to make a bunch of huge spaceships instead. As we mentioned last episode, in any civilization with self-replicating machines, it's sophistication, not size, that matters. On astronomical timelines, a bunch of self-replicators breeding themselves up to sufficient numbers to turn an asteroid into a giant space hulk, or thousands of them, is trivial compared to journey length. Indeed, a tiny data ship might take quite some time to fully build just because of the data transfer. Just because some tiny wafer might be able to hoard a trillion bytes of data does not mean it can be loaded with them in the blink of an eye. You'd probably incinerate it trying to do so. The second caveat is that these are assumed to be ultra-tiny and fast, but that's highly exaggerated. Ship speed is entirely dependent on ship drive type, not ship size. Indeed, with most hypothetical interstellar drive concepts, like using H-bombs for propellant, fusion reactors, or Kugelblitz black holes, the drive needs to be big to work, and often grows more efficient scaled up. There's no point in going small. Things using reflective sails to be sped up or slowed down by a pushing laser also need to be quite big. The bigger the sail, the easier it is to focus a beam on and for longer. Even for something like antimatter, its containment and drive system is unlikely to be tiny and will benefit from a larger scale. Fuel might scale linearly, but in terms of your dry mass, in terms of ship components versus payload, bigger is better. So counterintuitively, we'd expect bigger ships to be faster than smaller ones, at least in terms of maximum speed. Acceleration is another matter. Big ships will be more limited in this regard, and anything organic will be more so, compared to something mechanical or digital. As we've discussed before, acceleration rates are pretty irrelevant for interstellar travel. The journey length is just so long that you hit your maximum speed fairly early on, whether you're pushing acceleration rates that would turn a human into a gooey pancake, or one so small they'd barely feel them. We should also not forget the other size limitation, which is shielding. The faster you go, the more stuff you run into in any given moment, the more damage it does, and the smaller your window for detection, evasion, deflection, or vaporization of such debris. So you need increasingly thicker armor and shielding, and if you get to really high speeds, you need to keep your engine on and burning fuel just to compensate for the drag you'll be experiencing. For the most part, this shielding is free, since you can usually use it at your destination. For biological life, it might be water or ice, it might be your fuel for a fusion drive, or it might be raw material to seed your self-replicating machines. But you'd still have to have it, and it still needs to be dumb matter, because it is going to get hammered too hard to hold complex patterns like DNA or data. This armor and shielding is a set thickness too. It goes up if you make the ship wider, but not longer. Some thumb drive-sized data ship still needs a meter of armor in front of it. Actually more, since it's particularly radiation sensitive. When you're storing data at the atomic or molecular level, there's no redundancy for each bit. A gamma ray hitting a book isn't erasing a letter when it strikes, it's just very tiny compared to that letter. This isn't to say this is not a good method. You absolutely can colonize a galaxy faster with von Neumann probes such as the Seed or Data ships than via more classic generation ships or sleeper ships, just not a lot faster. Especially if the folks building those generation ships have the same self-replicative technology. For the former, someone plants a von Neumann probe in an asteroid and tells it to make mini copies of itself, and a few days or weeks later, thousands or millions of ships the size of trucks, again it needs meters of shielding, erupt forth and accelerate as fast as they can till they hit their maximum speed. Another person plants a seed for classic generation ships, and they erupt a little later, ready for boarding, and accelerate a little slower, and all fly off to their destinations, probably every star system within a few hundred light years. The data ship probably gets to shave a couple years off their journey time tops, which isn't much for a journey that could easily last millennia. Even if we assume successive waves that stopped every 100 light years to slow down, replicate, and speed back up, and that a von Neumann probe only needed a week stopover while the generation ship needed an entire decade, that still means only 1,000 stops on a 100,000 light year journey, about 10,000 years saved, which isn't very much considering that even if they are going near light speed, that's 100,000 years for von Neumann probes, and 110,000 for the generation ships. If the maximum speed is a tenth the speed of light though, that's a million year expedition, against which an extra 10,000 is trivial. And of course, even a million years is pretty short in astronomical timelines. If we assumed our galaxy was a middle-aged person, every million years would just be a day in their lifetime thus far. Shaving off 10,000 years is shaving off about 15 minutes. So it's not about advantage, just preference. You might be thinking that if it's a race, whoever arrives first, be it by a single footfall or a kilometer, wins. But keep in mind that in a foot race, the guy in second place is not allowed to run up to you with a baseball bat and clobber you and take your trophy. You're only ahead of them because they grew a bigger ship and accelerated it slower and decelerated slower. They don't have to do all three of those. And as we always remind people, there is no such thing as an unarmed spaceship. Any von Neumann probe still has to slow down to make use of a system. A relativistic kill missile, RKM, does not have to slow down, and indeed can burn its fuel to speed up even more. It's going to catch you before you arrive and can build defenses or backup copies, because it does not need to slow down. Various rival factions looking to colonize space don't have to be friendly, but their methods do have to be tolerable. Even assuming you can keep it a secret, you're going to colonize the whole galaxy and leave none for anyone else, they'll chase you down, There is no stealth in space, especially when accelerating out of systems at full thrust. But you couldn't keep it a secret, because no one is going to be casual about just deploying self-replicators somewhere in the solar system to build whatever, because you could be building whatever. After all, if you send out a fleet of colonizers, your main civilization is still on Earth, where everybody can gang up on you for retribution. So it makes more sense to attack them first with some replicated swarm of drone warships that you turn into colony vessels afterwards. And now you can take your sweet time to colonize the galaxy. Diplomacy does not exist because people are nice and friendly. It exists because we often are not. And hyperfast, reckless aggressive colonization is likely to be interpreted as a hostile act, especially if denying possible territory to others is seen as your primary goal and motivation. Barring the first few colonies to get our eggs out of one basket and prove we can, odds are each world colonized after that will be done with its own specific motives, and those impact which colony ship type you use a lot. An ideological or religious group that believes in a more primitive existence is likely to still be fine employing technology to colonize a world to achieve that goal, but it is unlikely to want to use the digital route if they can use a more classic generation ship instead. So you use the approach that suits your needs and tastes. Obviously, if you're an entirely digital civilization, you use data ships. If not, then you probably won't, or at least limit how you use them. Those will often be restricted or influenced by your ideology, motives, and goals for a colony mission. And it should be assumed that many colony missions will represent a less mainstream viewpoint. Leaving your home system behind is a very big step, often most easily taken if you feel your views are not compatible with the place you live. Folks who are happy at home are less likely to go on long journeys. This brings up the inevitable Fermi paradox issues, though, about if anyone would colonize the galaxy in the first place, and we can point to all these and show how easily it probably would be. You don't really need to turn your entire civilization into a workforce dedicated for generations to assembling your colonial assets. You just need some volunteers to go on the ships. Except with data ships and even seed ships, you don't even need that. You can just send copies of people out to do the job, or AIs you create from scratch. And while I can't imagine we'd be short of volunteers to go, they don't actually have to go, just send a copy. They don't even have to do that, since you can send your von Neumann probes off to bring material home, something that wouldn't require anything approaching a human-level intelligence, just the capabilities of something you might develop for mining precious metals from our own asteroids. A relatively tiny ship that arrives at an asteroid, unpacks, makes the mining machinery and return cargo vessels. It doesn't even need to be able to build more of itself, a handy protection against mutation and various Grey Goo scenarios. So long as the cost for the initial packet to be sent is significantly less than the value of the raw materials returned, who cares if your mining probe can only kick out a few hundred system mining machines before it breaks down? And if they all break a couple decades later, after extracting and sending home a few megatons of raw materials each, you just send more. As to what we do with all that mass, you can actually pack thousands of solar masses around our own sun easily enough, or even build one of the birch planets we discussed in Mega-Earths, whose maximum size restriction was slightly in excess of an entire galaxy's mass. So even if you are a stay-at-home civilization, it doesn't mean you aren't harvesting the whole galaxy, or even many of them, so that you can have a bigger or longer lasting civilization at home. So fundamentally, this all comes down to preferences and available technology. If you can do it, you probably will. But what method would you use? We can't say, but we can say it probably won't be any of our five basic types in and of themselves. The Methuselah ship, the sleeper ship, the generation ship, the seed ship, and the data ship all have individual advantages and downsides. Some of those downsides are more a matter of taste and preference, but you'd likely use combinations or hybrids of each. Let's take an example. I am biological and want to stay more or less that way. I would rather a digital copy of me existed as a backup than cease to exist in our world, but my preference would be to have my life extended and keep my augmentations in that regard minimal. Tastes vary, and there's no real objective justification for that preference, but it seems to be a common one among the audience here. Probably the biggest faction, though it comes in many flavors. So for us, the Methuselahship is the default method. But a lot of folks might find the trip boring and want to spend it on ice, making it a Methuselah sleeper hybrid for those who don't. Many would probably opt to have a family during the trip, making it a generation ship too. Of course, most of us would be fine with being accompanied by those more cybernetically inclined than ourselves, or full-on digital. Indeed, it's often thought folks would tend to transition that way over time, slowly adding more augmentation, and eventually shrugging and just going into an uploaded digital form. Or something happens to their original body, and their digital backup gets woken up and decides it's happy as is, and will just remote control an android when it needs to be in the real world, or talk to its grandchildren when they log in to their various virtual bodies. Indeed, this is a very handy approach for population control on generation ships. If folks are expected to go on ice or digitize as they get older to make more room for younger people, both in a physical and social sense. And of course, if I'm making a really long journey, I might appreciate not having to spend centuries getting the basic colonial infrastructure and terraforming done in the first place. You probably already have probes, which can arrive sooner since they don't need to slow down, doing flybys on a system. You might use seed ships as a vanguard, leaving ahead of you, accelerating and decelerating faster, and giving you a jumpstart on some of your colonizing. Depending on how trustworthy your AI is, or sophisticated it is, you can let it get further ahead or stay as a pretty close vanguard, just arriving a few years early to gather raw materials and survey the system in detail. As we mentioned in Exodus Fleet, a good approach to slowing your colonial fleet down is to have a smaller vanguard arrive ahead to build a stelazor to slow your fleet. In the process of scaling that up, it might be setting up automated mines and factories, and once the stelazor is done, it can turn to other matters. This approach is also handy, since you can now use it for sending ships right back home again, or to neighboring colonies being established, or to push your colonial fleet back up to speed if part of it is moving on to colonize a new system. Remember, the big advantage of these kinds of ships isn't their maximum speed, it's the lag time spent speeding up, slowing down, and pausing in system to gather resources and replicate. So they're handy as a vanguard, as they can get there ahead of you, and can cut your own time in system down if your colonial fleet is just dropping off a portion of its people and gear, which can be replaced by breeding and manufacturing from newly acquired raw materials while en route to the next destination. This approach is our sixth type of colonial ship, the Gardener ship, and it isn't part of our core five because it's a hybrid, and it varies in purpose from the classic colony ship that just goes from point A to point B and stops. It will be our topic for the next time in the series. There is one last use for seed ships if you don't want them manned by people. Your goal for a new system might be to recreate an early era, for instance, a planet-sized Jurassic Park, or to mine it remotely and send the goods home, without worry that a budding colony there might go independent and stop sending resources home or tack on some fees. You might do it to seed it with basic life compatible to that planet and see what emerges down the road, a sort of intentional cosmic panspermia, a concept we'll look at more next month. Such a ship need not necessarily have a very sophisticated AI on board either, especially for the automated mining route, where you probably want it rather on the stupid side compared to a human, smart enough to do the job, but not to spread to new solar systems, or evolve intelligence and a rival civilization or machine rebellion. That is still a very sophisticated AI compared to what we have now, but we do have AI now, and they are getting quite sophisticated and useful. If you're interested in learning more about those AI, and maybe programming them yourself, making a career of it, then you might want to check out some of the courses on artificial intelligence, machine learning, and neural networks at Skillshare. They are an online community with over 20,000 courses on everything from technical topics like AI to fun or practical ones like cooking or business skills. So if you want to improve your skills, unlock new opportunities, and do the work you love, you can get a premium membership and have unlimited access to classes on those topics and many more. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. To sign up, go to skl.sh/Isaac5. Again, go to skl.sh/Isaac5 to get 2 months of unlimited access to over 20,000 classes for free. Act now for this special offer and start learning today. So this wraps us up for the year. We'll be skipping our live stream this month in deference to New Year's, but we'll be coming back strong next year to explore more about virtual worlds, simulations, and the Fermi paradox. The week after that, we'll look at colonizing new star systems, not by journeying to them, but by creating them instead, in Making Suns. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And if you enjoyed this episode, you can support the channel on Patreon or like and share the episode with others. Until next time, thanks for watching and have a happy new year.